From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Next week, Israelis go to the polls, a big national vote. Benjamin Netanyahu is widely expected to emerge again as Israeli prime minister. For distant observers, that continuity can mask a big change. Israel has turned hard to the right. Israeli conservatives welcome that as a hard-nosed response to dangerous times. Israeli liberals ask what's happened to their country. This hour on Point, we talk to two prominent Israelis about Israeli politics and their divergent visions for the future. You can join the conversation. Have you kept up with the political evolution of Israel? Do you welcome it? Do you fear it? And what does it mean for America? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from Tel Aviv is Ari Shavit, senior columnist for the liberal-leaning newspaper Haaretz. He describes himself as center-left. His book, My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel, will be published by Random House in May. Ari Shavit, welcome to On Point. Great to have you with us today.
Pleasure and honor to be on your program, Tom.
And with us today from London is Dani Dayan. He just stepped down last week as chairman of the Yesha Council, the main political body of the settler movement in Israel. He's a strong backer of Benjamin Netanyahu and the conservative Likud party. He's been a longtime critic of the two-state solution and imagines a West Bank thickly settled with Israelis and many Palestinians leaving to live in Jordan. Dani Dayan, thank you very much for joining us today from London.
Hi, Tom, from cold London.
Not in Israel. Let me put the same question to each of you first, and I'll start with you, Dani. Who do you expect to emerge as prime minister after next week's election, and what do you think that means for Israel's future?
Well, I will surprise you. I know that conventional wisdom in Israel has been from day one of the electoral campaign, even before that, that the current prime minister, Mr. Netanyahu, will prevail and will win with a big margin and will easily form a new government, a new coalition. Well, I think that he has the most chances, but I don't think that the election is already decided. Who will win, who will be the next prime minister? There are very powerful forces, both in Israel and abroad, that are working very hardly or very consistently in order to make that not happen. Call a few of them in Israel, large parts of the media are doing an effort, a big effort to topple Mr. Netanyahu, even with the inaccurate information and with leaks. Former politicians, the former prime minister, Mr. Ehud Olmert, who I do not underestimate his political skills, is doing all he can in order to change the course of these elections. Former generals, former security service chiefs, and mostly, unfortunately, the president of Israel, Mr. Shimon Peres, who, although he has he's a figurehead, the head of state, in this case he has he's deep in the pool trying to change the course of actions. Of course, also in your country, we read today leaks from the White House attributed to President Barack Obama, in which, again, he tries to intervene in the electoral process in Israel in order to diminish the chances of Mr. Netanyahu to prevail. Nevertheless, I am cautiously optimistic. I think that the Israeli electorate recognizes that Mr. Netanyahu has directed the politics of Israel in a very able way in the last 4 years. Still, he is the candidate with most chances, but the game is not over, definitely not.
If he wins, what do you hope or think that means for Israel's future?
Well, Israel, you know, is a small country with a myriad of very serious problems. The political system of Israel differs completely from that of the United States, a presidential regime versus a parliamentary one. with the very chaotic political system in Israel. Nevertheless, I think that if I take a look at the candidates that could emerge as prime minister after the elections or at the head of the different political parties, I think there is a colossal difference in the stature and the ability of Mr. Netanyahu and that of all others. All others are novices, are unexperienced persons, or those that already failed in positions of power. So, first of all, I think that if Mr. Netanyahu prevails and wins the re-election, we will have a government more able. From my ideological point of view, I think that look, we are in a quite this election is quite peculiar in the sense that it has no definitive agenda. Israelis are used to go to the polls in order to decide who will run better the negotiations with the Arab world, the Palestinians, and the security issues. Since this time, all Israelis, virtually all Israelis, understand that there is an impasse that is not Israel to blame for, but the Palestinians. And nothing dramatic is going to occur in that area, in the area of the negotiations with the Palestinians in the coming years. Then the electoral campaign should have been on domestic issues, like in every normal country. But we Israelis are not used to conduct a political battle over domestic issues. So I think that this has brought this electoral campaign to even, I would say, a farce of a beauty pageant more than an electoral campaign.
Donny Dayan, hold the thought there. Let me bring Ari Shavidian from Tel Aviv. And Ari, let me just begin with the same question for you. What are you expecting to emerge from next week's big Israeli vote? Who do you expect to emerge as prime minister? And what do you think that means for Israel's future?
Well, in Israel, anything can happen. In the Middle East, as we've just seen, anything can happen. So one has to be very cautious with the prophecies. But it will be a dramatic surprise if Mr. Netanyahu does not emerge as prime minister. So the likely result of the elections is Netanyahu as prime minister and a very right-wing parliament. Let me stress the important point here. Mr. Netanyahu is something of an enigma. He's a right winger on the one hand, but I would say he represents a kind of respectable right in some other ways. What the dramatic change that we see is underneath Mr. Netanyahu, because what we see is extreme right wing forces who actually took over his own party and have actually turned him into the lefty of the right wing Likud party. And we see extreme right-wing forces emerging with a new right-wing party that even Danny Dayan does not support. And then we have the ultra-Orthodox force. So you are going to have a combination of one, so to speak, secular right-wing party, then a nationalist religious right-wing party, which is very much the settlers' party, and the traditional ultra-Orthodox forces. The combination of these three forces will turn even Mr. Netanyahu into a hostage of extreme right-wing forces. And this is what I see as the likely and the very dangerous result of these elections.
Why dangerous? What policy do you see emerging there, or what danger?
Look, there are two or three different issues here. Let me begin with the question of occupation. I'm not a naive peacenik. I've been skeptic about previous peace processes. I've supported them ideologically, but I realized that they had flaws in them. I'm not a naive dove. I'm a realistic dove. But what we might see here is two great dangers. One, if we'll see more settlement activity in the West Bank, the two-state solution, which I agree cannot be fully implemented right now, but it might die altogether. And as a result, Israel will have to choose whether it stops being a Jewish state or whether it stops being a democratic state. This is, for me as a liberal Zionist, a terrible, terrible danger. The other danger is that Israel will run into a head-on collision with the West, with the United States and with Europe and with our allies in the West, because there is a limit to the gap you can have between the values of democratic Zionist Israel, which have been supported for decades, if not generations, by the West, and the new reality appearing. So again, although I'm not naive about the prospects of immediate peace, I think Israel must make for its own good, for its moral values, for its values as a democracy, and for its political prospect. It must be committed to the two-state solution, to the idea of trying to end occupation in a cautious and realistic way over a long period of time. And if we don't do that, we might end up as a new South Africa, which for me is a real, real nightmare.
But do you think that political party or powers that welcome a two-state solution are likely to win next week, to win power?
Not at all. Not at all. We will see the parties who support who do not support the two-state solution having the upper hand in the next elections.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Israel's politics. 1 week before big national elections there, Ari Shavit joins us today from Tel Aviv, an Israel senior columnist for Haaretz. Look for his book, My Promised Land, coming out in May from Random House. And with us today, Dani Dayan. He stepped down just last week of chairman of the Yesha Council. That's the main political body of the settler movement, which has become very politically potent in Israel. He's a big backer of Benjamin Netanyahu and the conservative Likud party in the election next week. Dani Dayan, help us, if you would, with your picture of the future and how you see what some conservatives, maybe many conservatives in Israel at this point now see, sort of pro-settler movement people. One of your fellow Israelis, Naftali Bennett, is getting a lot of attention these days, very prominent. Some people see him as a future conservative prime minister of Israel, even. And I'm reading here talking about how he sees ultimately, yes, a two-state solution, but the West Bank would be Israeli, maybe annexed, and Jordan would be Palestine. Is that your vision for the future, Dani? Do you agree with it?
Well, Tom, first of all, I think that the two-state solution never existed as a solution. It was a mirage. It was stillborn in Oslo more than 20 years ago and never was a viable political outcome of the conflict. For a myriad of reasons, I don't think this is the framework to discuss them. By the way, I have to correct you, I never advocated immigration of Palestinians from what you call the West Bank or Judea and Samaria.
No, I was reading here from an interview with
of the world.
Yeah, I was reading from Naftali Bennett, and I don't know where
okay.
you come down on.
No,
that
in the introduction, I think you referred to my advocating immigration of Palestinians. I never did.
Forgive
but
me.
I do agree with Naftali, if that is what he said, that the ultimate solution to the conflict will be a regional one, in which control or the responsibility over the West Bank, over Judea and Samaria, will be shared by two states, Israel, the Jewish state, west of the Jordan, and a Palestinian state, east of the Jordan. And as I said, the joint responsibility of some kind, not joint sovereignty, but responsibility by the two states over the patch of land known as Judea and Samaria, or the West Land, each nation state over its citizenship there, but we are not there now.
But east of the Jordan River right now, if I may, east of the Jordan River is the country of Jordan, the kingdom of Jordan right now. So what happens to that in your vision?
You know, Tom, I have been to Jordan a few months mm-hmm. ago, and I saw the pictures of the king and his son, his 17 or 18-year son, bespectacled son, and everywhere a regime that needs this kind of propaganda in order to have the loyalty of the population is a regime that is weak. Monarchy is a primitive way of government. I mean, no less primitive than, for instance, apartheid, that, of course, I oppose vehemently both. I don't believe that, I am sure that the monarchy in Jordan will be changed in a matter of days, weeks, months, or years, but it will happen. It must happen because, you know, civilization advances and monarchies are going to disappear. A few hundred years ago, the whole world was ruled by monarchies, and these days, I'm talking from London, of course, I don't mean the British monarchy, but I will not be disrespectful to the queen from here, but I mean, of course, monarchies in which the monarch rules.
So in Jordan's case, what does that mean to you? It would become a Palestinian state, not a monarchy, and the West Bank would what? Be annexed by Israel or shared?
I suppose, Tom, that the Palestinian majority, Jordan is a country with a predominant Palestinian majority, I suppose that when that happens, the Palestinian majority will take the helm, and that will pose a lot of dangerous scenarios, but also some optimistic ones. The challenge of the whole world, not only of Israel in that case, will be to differentiate between the very dangerous scenarios and the beneficial ones, try to avert the dangerous one, and try to help coming into reality the beneficial ones. But we are not there now. It may happen in 10 or 20 years. For the time being, my good friend Ari, is when he talks about democracy or apartheid, he's mistaken, because he supposes that his assumption is that there is going to be a new final status situation, that it's either democratic or apartheid. No, there is not going to happen. We are still stuck in the temporary, in a modus vivendi that will not be the final status solution of the conflict. And this is a modus vivendi we have to remind ourselves, in which 98% of the Palestinians are ruled by the Palestinian Authority in 98% of the areas of life. So the talk about occupation and oppression, etc., etc., is far, very far from the reality on the ground.
Donnie, hold the thought if you would. Ari Shavit, help me out here. I think for a lot of Americans who have spent years oriented toward peace process and two-state solution, this perspective can sound like a radical perspective. But is it radical in Israel today, Ari?
Very good question. Let me put it this way. First of all, as you and your listeners listen to Dani, Dayan, whom I have personal respect and even fondness to, let me not misled by his elegant language and sweet words. What is described here by the Israeli right, that by the settlers, is an attempt to take over. Everything that was dear and benign in Israel and in the Zionist project. The Zionist project was about giving a home to homeless people while causing the minimal damage and injustice to the others. The moment the Zionist movement and Israel becomes a permanent occupying force, which denies totally the rights of another people, that moment it becomes an unjust movement. And because I'm such an Israeli patriot, and because I believe in Zionism, and because I believe we can combine the need for a Jewish homeland with a democratic and progressive and just state, I see that what Dani describes in these elegant words of his is an alarming and deeply disturbing vision.
Why?
We cannot, for every reason, every possible reason. First one is the moral. I think we are a moral entity, we are a moral movement, and I would not let people turn us into an unjust movement which totally actually takes the land totally to itself and ignores the others. To say that the Palestinians are not under occupation today is ridiculous. You have millions and millions of Palestinians who are under direct or indirect occupation. Now, this is not our fault. It's a combination of the tragedy of the conflict. It's a result of it. But it is our duty, morally, first of all, to try to end that. Again, I'm not naive. It cannot end, and I'm not into, I don't think a final status agreement can be reached today or tomorrow. Yeah. But our aim, the moral aim of Israel should be that we will try to end it as soon as possible and as much as possible. But beyond that, there are demographic elements, there are realpolitik elements. We cannot, as long as we turn our project into a tainted project by doing this to the other people, as long as we could keep other people under our occupation, and we increased the crisis that or the conflict with the Arab world, which is bad enough as it is. This is morally, demographically, politically futile and impossible.
But Ari, let me ask you the same question here, because again, a lot of Americans are still kind of anchored in peace process and two-state solution years, and Israeli politics have evolved, they've changed. Is this kind of goal that Donny talks about, that Naftali Bennett talks about, is that, I ask again, is that radical in Israel today, or is it mainstream?
I think it is. Let me, with all this, I express your concern and even some gloom, but let me tell you where I'm optimistic. I don't think that what Dani tells you and what Naftali Bennett is about and what this new Likud, right-wing Likud is about, I don't think this is real Israel. What we see now in Israel is a complete political failure of the Israeli center-left. The forces, the right-wing forces that are powerful in this campaign and are going to be powerful in the next parliament are not the real country, because most Israelis still are committed to the two-state. They're willing to make concessions. They want, although they're pessimistic about peace, but they realize they're not that committed to the greater Israel idea or to the settlement movement.
How can you say not the real Israel today when they're winning elections and they're expected to win again next week?
I'll give you an American example. Mm. When I visited my progressive friends in the December of 2004, they felt that America is all about conservatism, religious feelings, and evangelist domination. 4 years later, America elected an almost radical, a liberal president from Chicago. So things change, and sometimes you see a certain political picture. Don't think that it's the entire new nature of the state. I think there is still a strong battle. The right-wing forces are very strong now. I think that when reality will strike, and it will strike on the ground and internationally immediately after the elections, I think there is hope that the old new sober and benign Israeli majority will emerge again and will defeat these forces. Right now we see a very gloomy picture, but I do not want your listeners to feel that this is the new Israel and that the old, more liberal Israel is gone. I think that is it might happen, but I think it's not the case yet. I think there is that most Israelis are willing to be and there is a point here that I have to explain. It's true that the old peace process, as it was promoted for years, has failed. It's true that the new reality in the new Middle East poses new challenges, and therefore old-fashioned peace ideas are irrelevant. That is true. Mm. What we must forge now is a new peace concept, how to move, again, slowly, cautiously towards the two-state solution without naive ideas of naive romantic peace that we had 20 years ago, but without turning Israel into a real apartheid, permanent occupying force. This is unacceptable. I think that reality will force us to abandon these fantasies, but I also think that the majority of Israelis, if they will be presented with the right concept of a realistic two-state vision, long-term vision, I think, and with the right leadership, I think that just like the Democratic America emerged again with Clinton and with Obama, and it proved vital after years that it seemed doomed and lost, I think that the same will happen in Israel towards the next election.
Ari, stand by. Dani Dayan, how about it? Ari Shavit suggests that your perspective does not represent the real Israel. His words. What do you say to that?
Well, I surprisingly agree with the framework of the analysis of Ari Shavit. I mean, the situation, the solution, even the modus vivendi should be moral, morally justified, and should be wise. He called it realpolitik, should be wise in political terms. I also agree that the Israeli public opinion, the Israeli electorate is volatile, and I wouldn't draw too sharp conclusions from one election or even two elections to the eternal future. But I differ completely with my friend Ari Shavit regarding the substance. I think that calling the current situation an immorality from Israel's perspective, it's completely erroneous. Look, the conflict between Jews and Palestinians is a peculiar one in the sense that those are two ethnic groups that are completely sincere in their feelings, and their feelings are aspirations, not only feelings, and you cannot reconcile these two both sincere aspirations and visions. We Jews, we the Zionists, see ourselves as a people that returned to its ancient homeland after 2,000 years, yearning, praying three times a day, each day, to do it. And the Palestinians, maybe rightfully so from their perspective, see us as a 19th century colonialist endeavor. Now, in such a situation in which the two perspectives, the two visions are sincere, are not artificial, you could say that the just solution is partition. But what happens when one side accepts partition and the other rejects it?
A two-state solution.
But not the partition of the land, call it two-state solution, yep, or partition, there are synonyms. And the other side not only rejects it, but launches an aggression in order to take it all by force.
But which side is which? Who are you describing?
The history is very clear. The Zionist movement.
I mean, going all the way back.
Partition in 47, in 67, in 2000, in 2008.
But you no longer accept partition, right?
Palestinians rejected. I am not an admirer. I'm not an advocate of partition. But the Jewish establishment, the government of Israel, did accept partition. I suspect that I even agree with Ari Shavit that the majority of the Israeli public would accept partition. But the moment the Palestinians not only rejected partition, but launched an aggression, two or three aggressions, in order to prevent partition, partition ceased to be the just solution to the conflict.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Israeli politics 1 week before a big national election in Israel, a country in the middle of a region in dramatic change, a country that's seen dramatic change itself in its own politics over the years, maybe more change than some Americans have kept up to date with. We're catching up today. Dani Dayan joins us from London, Israeli, but in London today. Just stepped down last week as chairman of the Yesha Council. It's the main political body of the settler movement in Israel, a very potent movement there right now. Ari Shavit is a senior columnist for Haaretz, identifies himself as center-left, has called himself as despairing over Israeli politics lately. His new book, My Promised Land, will be out in May. Ari, Dani, let me begin to bring our listeners in. They've been paying close attention. Justine is calling from New Milford, Connecticut. Justine, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks. I appreciate your attention to this ongoing issue. I'm a psychologist. I spent a bunch of time in Israel-Palestine, and I see you know, a different picture from what Diane is saying. There's certainly, you know, land being taken from Palestinians and so forth. But my question really is, there's a movement around the world now with lots of one-state solution conferences. As you know, Tom, there was just one last spring at Harvard that was oversubscribed. As an American, with all our difficulties, including slavery, et cetera, I don't know why it would be so difficult to imagine Israel-Palestine becoming really what it is already, one state, a state for all the citizens of people who live there, one democratic state that was the homeland for two peoples. So I'd really like to hear why that would be so bad.
And Justine, by that, do you mean Israelis and Palestinians living in exactly the same terrain and all having equal vote?
Right. In other words, you know, people like Maren Benvenisti for the last few years have said that this is an egg that can't be unscrambled. It's already a one de facto state. It's just that a group of people have more rights than the other. And so many people, you know, there are growing polls even among Palestinian Israeli citizens to have a state for all its citizens, to have the same rights, and to have the same rights from the River Jordan to the Mediterranean.
Justine, let us pick it up with my Israeli guest, Ari Shavit. I'll come first to you. You said this would this path would be apartheid or the end of democracy. Justine says why?
Yes. It, by the way, it might be even a bit worse. It might be the end of life. Let put it this way. I'll give two arguments here. Mm. One, I think that these two peoples, each one of them, deserves a nation state of its own. I envy people living in the United States. You're blessed with a peaceful, democratic country. In the Middle East, there is no chance for two peoples who are in many ways tribes, who have so much bitterness between them, to live side by side for in one entity. Each one of them deserves to the right of self-determination in its own nation state, giving justice and hopefully peace to the other. But if this is not clear, or this was not clear years back, let's look at our region. We've tried the one-state solution in Lebanon. It ended up with terrible civil war, and to this moment, the situation between Shiites, Sunnis, and Christians is very, very fragile. There was this bold attempt to have a one-state solution in Syria between Alawites and Sunnis, who are not, there are no Jews there, there's no bitter history of the same, of the kind Palestinians and Jews have in Israel and in Palestine. You see what is happening now in Syria. I assure you that any attempt to implement the one-state solution in Israel and Palestine will end in a massacre, which will be much, much worse than what we see daily, and we turn our eyes from it in Syria. So I think that this is a noble, benign idea, completely detached from reality, and cannot be implemented on the ground in any sort of way. And out of these benign and moral ideas, you might end up with a terrible, terrible, terrible human catastrophe.
But you hear Justine saying, look, the eggs are scrambled. You know, how do you fix this? Now, you know, you have some who are saying, well, you know, I mean, you hear Dani Dayan's solution here, yes, and you reject that. So where does that leave you?
So first of all, this is where Justine and Dani Dayan really agree. They want us to go. This is the irony, that the extreme left and extreme right want to take us to the same hellish future. They do not want it. I know everybody means well, but the outcome of anything but the two-state solution will be hellish. It will not only be immoral, it will be hellish. And therefore, I agree that many mistakes were made. I opposed the settler movement and project from the beginning because I realized what will happen with this scrambled egg. But I think the need is so ultimate that we must do the utmost to stop it. And because right now I agree that it's very difficult in the present situation, being realistic, to have a peace agreement. That's out of the question right now, unfortunately. We have to try it, but it's not realistic. I think that the first step should be a better and improved version of what President Obama tried in 2009, which is to stop settlement activity. The mistake President Obama made, if I may say so, was not to make distinction between different kind of settlements. If the new international idea would be to stop settlement activity beyond the blocks, the major settlement blocks, beyond the line, the barrier, that would stop the deterioration towards a one-state solution. It will not bring us to peace tomorrow, but it will be an act that will be an act of goodwill to the Palestinians.
But isn't Israel going the other way, Ari? The way
right now, Israel is going the other way. But this is why my prediction is that we are going to have a major clash with reality here. I think that the new right-wing Israeli government that will probably be elected, first of all, does not really reflect the deep wishes of most Israelis. Two, it's in complete collision with the international community. And three, it's in collision with the Palestinians and with the Arab world around us. Therefore, unfortunately, I for years have fought for trying to bring us to do the right thing before we hit the wall. Unfortunately, my prediction right now is that we probably will have right-wing government, will hit the wall, hopefully a political wall and not a terribly violent wall. And when we all learn from this collision, we'll have to go back and to look for a realistic way forward. But let me put a point here. I think one of the reasons the right is so strong in Israel is because the people on the left, the peace camp in Israel, and the international community did make terrible mistakes in the naive peace idea that they promoted for years. We, on the peace-loving people, the center-left in Israel and the international community, have to learn the lessons from our mistakes. Most Israelis are not stupid and not that extreme. If they will be presented with a realistic two-state solution idea, with a realistic idea of how to move forward, with a realistic idea of how not to get into those hellish scenarios, I believe they will be attracted by them. But we have to be creative and not to stick to 20-year-old peace ideas, which indeed have stopped being relevant.
Let's go to Susan in Darien, Connecticut. Susan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
I'd like to know what your guests think President Obama has done or not done to help foster conversations between Israel and the Palestinians. To me, he kind of signaled a sympathetic view when he took office, that he saw the plight of the Arab world and in particular sort of sent a more sympathetic signal. And then you see his cold attitude toward Netanyahu. I feel as though he's not really helping the process, and because nothing's moving forward, you have this sort of infighting in Israel.
Susan, let us pick it up. Dani Dayan, how about it? Susan suggests that maybe something about President Obama's attitude has derailed progress toward a two-state solution or peace process. Do you agree?
Well, I think there are two Presidents Obama. There is the President Obama of the first half of his administration. I'm talking about his first administration, of course. And during those 2 years, he made a lot of mistakes regarding the Middle East, if I may respectfully say so. I think that he didn't fully understand the complexity of the conflict in the Middle East.
But you don't want a two-state solution anyway. So what?
Yes, but... But the problem is, you know, Tom, the problem, yeah. I don't think the problem is what I want or what I do not want. The problem is, the question is what is possible and what is not possible. A two-state solution is just not possible. How do I know about that? You know, I was taught in college, in university, there are two ways to prove a theorem. You can do it empirically or analytically. So, it's easier, you don't have enough time to get into the full analysis of the situation, but let's start with the empiric proof that is much shorter. Look, Tom, you can't doubt Prime Minister Netanyahu's sincerity when he talks about a two-state solution. I myself really don't know. Sincerely, I do not know if he's sincere or not. There are mornings in which I wake up and I think he's sincere. There are mornings in which I wake up, I think he's bluffing the whole world. Mm. And I suspect that the same thing happens to Netanyahu himself. But you cannot deny the sincerity of his predecessor, Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, in achieving a two-state solution. He was deeply, I would even say messianically, religiously dedicated to this cause. And he offered the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas the most far-reaching offer that an Israeli Prime Minister will ever present his Palestinian counterpart for a peace deal. You can read the memoirs of Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. She couldn't believe her eyes when she saw the offer that Olmert extended to Abu Mazen, to Mahmoud Abbas. And even that offer that gave him everything, a Palestinian state, 67 borders, territorial swaps, de facto internationalization of the Holy Basin in Jerusalem, etc., etc., even that thing was rejected by the Palestinians. Olmert did not even get a response. A few months later, Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, gave an interview to the Washington
Post. Take us forward, Danny. We know this history. We've lived it.
Said that, so if Olmert didn't succeed to bring the Palestinians to sign a peace deal, no one can do that because the Palestinians do not want it. Or at least because there is no convergence point between Israel minimal demands and Palestinian minimal demands.
Let me get a call right here. Doreen in Simsbury, Connecticut. I got it, Donnie. Doreen, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi. Well, what I think is that getting rid of the Palestinians is not going to solve our problem. I grew up in Israel, and Israelis don't want to fight anymore. They don't want to have a war. And if you throw the Palestinians back into Jordan, what is that going to do? What is that?
I did not suggest that. I did not suggest that. Not at all. I don't think that. Not
then
even
how are you
one person.
Get rid of them?
I'm not going to get rid of them. I think they are human beings, and I do not want to get rid of them. I don't want them, neither them, to get rid of me. That's the whole issue. But I am not proposing, I'm not advocating that anyone, Jew or Palestinian, is forcibly moved from his home.
Though there are prominent voices in this settler movement who would foresee that.
Well, you know, there are also prominent radio anchors that have weird ideas. I mean, I am talking for myself. And for the mainstream, the vast majority of settlers, not just for myself.
Doreen, what do you think?
Well, what about having a win-win situation where we have two countries that live together symbiotically, and we, you know, have universities, and the Palestinians go to our universities, they go to, and the Israelis go to theirs. What about having peace? Something that we've all wanted since day one. All the songs that we had when we were children were about peace and how happy we would be when peace came to Israel. What about all that?
I agree with you, but it's not going to happen. Look, a de facto independent Palestinian state was established in Gaza. It's a de facto independent Palestinian state. So we have the experiment. The experiment was already done. And every single penny, every single cent, every single dollar and euro that was contributed to that de facto independent Palestinian state in Gaza was used to amass more weapons against Israel, not to establish universities and schools and hospitals and highways. That's the frustrating reality. The difference is that I have to deal with realities and not with utopic illusions.
Ari Shavit, Tom Friedman quotes you in his column saying that under the patronage of a radical rightist America, we Israel can conduct a radical rightist policy without paying the price. Is that umbrella still there? What's that price, Ari? Is there one?
Yeah, I think one of the things you see here, and you hear it in this program, is that Israel is being taken over by an Israeli Tea Party. Now, as you had the American Tea Party dominant in American politics, the Israeli Tea Party could have gotten away with this to an extent. I think these days are over, and therefore the contrast and the collision, I fear, is all too obvious now, because there is no way, and I want to repeat that, Israel was based and is based on democratic values, on liberal values, on humanistic values. It was never naive. It was tough. It fought for itself. But justice, morality, democracy were always part of its DNA. These new forces that are now emerging dismiss this. They take for granted the support we get from the West, but they do not actually hold and are not committed to the values the West holds sacred. And this is the great danger. I believe that eventually the old Israel will come back, and the new Israel that will emerge after this dark period be one we can all be proud of, and one that can be moral, just, and be a Jewish homeland that Jews and Israelis can be proud of and not ashamed of.
We will watch closely next week as Israelis go to the polls. We are grateful to each of you for your time today. Ari Shavit at Haaretz, joining us from Tel Aviv. Thank you very much. We'll look for your book, My Promised Land, out in May. Thank you, Ari.
Thank you very much.
And Dani Dayan, joining us today from London, just stepped down as chairman of the Yesha Council. Dani, thank you very much for your time
today. Thank you very much, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.